Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is The Other Thing I Do. My guest this week is Eric Johnson, an actor you may have seen as Everett Gallinger in The Nick, as Luke Callahan in Rookie Blue, and as Jack Hyde in 50 Shades Darker. He reprises that role alongside Dakota Johnson and Jamie Dornan in 50 Shades Freed, in theaters everywhere this Friday, February 9th. Eric picked Children of Men, Alfonso Cuarón's devastating dystopian thriller set in a worn-out London some 2 decades after humans have stopped being able to bear children. Life is over, the future is dead, and hope is lost. Unless it isn't, and that's where the story begins. With an incredible cast that includes Clive Owen, Julianne Moore, Michael Caine, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Danny Huston, and the amazing Claire Hope Ashaty, it's a magnificent work of near-future science fiction and one of the best films made in the last couple of decades. Filled with terrific performances, surprising creative choices, riveting set pieces, and, well, everything, really. I said it was one of the best. If you haven't seen it, you're definitely going to want to do that before you listen to this episode. And if you haven't seen it in a while, I think you're going to want to see it again. This is Someone Else's Movie.
This is going to be a really short conversation on my side. And as I rewatched the movie this morning.
Oh, wow.
And it's perfect. So it's up to you to tell me how it's not.
Oh, God.
Because it's the movie is I remember seeing it in the theater and sitting down, and I hadn't had that kind of adrenaline rush and emotional feeling and adrenaline rush in a film in I don't know how long. And it came out, and I'm like, this is one of the top films of the decade. It's one of my top 5 films of all time, from a story standpoint and a technical standpoint and how it was achieved. I was just blown away. And I'm like, this movie should win all of the things, because it's a triumph. It's like, everybody go see this. And everybody didn't go see it.
No, it was like pulling teeth.
I looked at the numbers there. I looked at the box office. It's a travesty. The movie is incredible. And being able to look at it again today and seeing the movie's even more relevant today than when it came out. And it's kind of brilliant that being able to see the layers on it now too, of the little things, the pieces in the background and the way Alfonso Cuarón revealed them or just had them as part of the story.
Yeah.
This is his eye into that world, and the POV he takes you on it's an incredible journey with great performances, great sound design and music and cinematography, and it just, the list goes on and on and on and on. So it's the reason I picked it is, it's, to me, it is a triumph of everything that cinema should be.
I'm not going to say no. It's on my top 10 list as well for that decade. It was a movie that I never fully understood what went wrong with the marketing, because the film itself is, yeah, it should have been perfect. Mm-hmm. For me, my experience of it as a working film critic at the time was, it was one of the last things that was screened for us that year. It was,
it
a Christmas
came out like
release.
January 5th, I think.
Yeah.
Like after the holidays.
There was I think, we saw it, the TFCA saw it for consideration for that awards year. So either it was about to open and they moved it. It was a 10 a.m. screening, which means that was an awards thing. Universal doesn't usually do those.
Mm.
And we all went in and it just, like, it played to silence. The occasional laugh, but it played to just kind of shocked, pummeled silence.
Yeah.
And, like,
it's a punishing film.
It is, yeah.
It's work. And what I thought was brilliant is they did put these little moments of levity in there, and these little, you know, jokes of dark comedy that that just help break the tension for a moment.
Yeah, the gallows humor is essential to it, and also you're seeing it in the real world now. Like, this is how we're handling the apocalypse unfolding in slow motion. Everything about the tone is dead right. The exhaustion, the kind of hollowed out nature of society.
Apathy. The misdirected anger at immigration and I mean, you know, thinking about this film, when was it, early 2005 or early 2006, like 11 years later, almost 12 years later, it's opening the DVD case.
Yes, I'm looking for a copyright notice. Copyright 2007, so it would have been 2006, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's so spot on with, you know, those feelings of Brexit and, you know, foreign policy and how we look at outsiders. And it's just taken to an extreme. I mean, that's the thing I also love about this sort of genre of sci-fi, where it's like 15 minutes in the future, where everything feels very tactile and real still, but it's just a little bit far away, so it makes it a little extra scary because this could be us.
Yeah, it's a likely progression. Mm-hmm. Like every emotion feels real because, yeah, we're, as you say, we're 15 minutes. Like it could happen tomorrow. It's the kind of futurism that is incredibly depressing because there's almost no hope to it, and that feels like the modern moment too. Like
it, but that's like what the movie is about.
Exactly,
the movie is about hope. The movie's about Michael Caine has this speech where he's talking about faith versus chance, and when chance takes something away from you, is your faith strong enough to hold on? And talking about how Clive Owen's character and the death of his son, that sort of takes his faith away.
Yeah.
And you know, he's got this bleak outlook on life, and then finds hope. And how far he's willing to go now to help preserve that. And I mean, I find myself as an individual being awfully cynical and can look at things and go, wow, this we've really piled a lot of horse shit onto this planet, and how the hell are we going to fix it? And if something like this happened, well, we kind of deserve it, which is what he even said to us. Like, we deserve all this. You know, like this happened, you know, the whole, if you don't know the movie, which you should, because it's amazing, it's the idea that for 18 years, no children have been born. It's like, so the world's women are infertile and they have no way of having any more children.
Right. It's the end of the line in so many ways. And what I love about the script, and the thing that no one ever talks about in these movies, the speculative fiction stuff, is the idea that we never know the details. Not that there was no cause. It doesn't matter what the cause was, but even the way in which it played out, even there's the suggestion that everyone miscarried at the same time, which is horrifying, but that's just floated very briefly.
Yeah.
It's never really discussed, and it's better that way because the idea that maybe that's what happened or how it happened, like in a short burst of kind of a viral outbreak going around the world, that's disturbing. But it's even more disturbing to not know for certain.
Absolutely.
To just
Not knowing your enemy.
Yeah.
There's nothing to go and conquer, right?
Yeah. And the idea that the whole world would be shattered by this thing that no one could understand, which is the most personal blow you can suffer, I understand, as I understand it, having never had kids. But, you know, short of the death of a child, it's the loss of a potential child. And the idea that most of the world's population is grappling with that on one level or another and has been for 18 years is just horrible in the extreme. And so it's like a Garcia Marquez kind of thing, a magic realist idea that's so intolerable you can't discuss it.
Yeah. I mean, it just the whole construct of what would society look like with no children. And what does that mean when you, because children, ultimately, when you look around, that represents the future. Like, you, how many things do we do in our lives that are for the future, or at least thinking, like, you know, retirement and all that sort of stuff. Sure, you get hit by a bus and it doesn't matter, but it's that idea of we're building towards something that keeps a lot of us going.
Right.
You know, whether it's putting money into your retirement or, you know, I've got some renovations I want to do on the house, we're all working for something. And if you take that idea of a future away, what does that do to a society? Well, as it shows in the movie, it's fractured. And you know, there's brilliant use of news footage and background environments and talking about how the rest of the world has fallen and sort of England is sort of struggling but hanging on by a thread.
Right.
Keep calm and carry on kind of thing. Yeah.
Again, utterly relevant to the moment.
Totally.
But also being misapplied, right? Because what you see is people who are used to getting coffee just before the coffee shop explodes and people die. It's the... I mean, it's a great opening because There's no music. There's no sense that anything is wrong. And then all of a sudden you're thrust into this horrible, harsh battle existence.
The thing that blows me away about this film, and again, it's going back and looking at it again, is the efficiency of storytelling. Mm-hmm. The efficacy of the camera and how it revealed things and how it showed things of character and the environment and the world. And the camera really is following Clive Owen's character, Theo, around. Hmm. But every once in a while, the camera breaks away from him and just takes you into this future world.
Yeah, it just wanders around.
It just takes you into this environment, which is incredibly unnerving. Because you feel like you're somewhat surrounded by it. And the opening, it absolutely does that. You start in this coffee shop, everybody enamored at the television of the death of the youngest person on the planet, which is exactly what humanity would do to this person. Yeah. He's done nothing, but he's a celebrity because he's the youngest person on the planet. And they've died. And it takes you out into the street, into London 2027. And just takes you in there. It doesn't follow Clive Owen's character anymore. It shows you the street. And then, you know, you see Clive Owen filling his coffee cup full of booze. Mm-hmm. And that tells you everything you need to know about Clive Owen's character. And then all of a sudden, coffee shop blows up that he was just in. And it's like, that's the world.
Yeah.
That's where we are.
It's great, too.
All one shot, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the thing. It's all one shot. It's so immersive.
So, and Cuarón, you know, now he's the master of the single take after mm-hmm. Gravity and the CG engineering that went into those, and it is an amazing...
But what's brilliant about this film is the lack of CG engineering. I will say, I don't know how he did these things because I purposefully didn't investigate how he did these things because I don't want to know.
That's great.
It's so good that there's an element of magic to it, and I don't want to peer behind the wizard's curtain because I don't want to know. It's just magic to me, like what he did. And you know, there may be a day where I learn or find out, but because I did see, you know, how he did this incredible shot in the car,
right,
of this amazing one take and how they did that, and I figured it was green screen when I watched the film, and then but then to see how they actually built this specific car,
yeah.
And you're going, it's mind blowing. Like the technical achievements in this film are, it pushed cinema forward, right? Yeah. It was a leap forward for movie making. You don't get Birdman without this film. You don't get Gravity without this film. Then the other thing was seeing some of the narrative and storytelling mechanisms that they use in Children of Men, of these longer shots, these still, you know, of focusing on what the story is as opposed to who's talking, mm-hmm. which drives me nuts. But then seeing how that influenced the show I did with Clive Owen called The Nick,
right,
where there's similarities in that in terms of even just the style, in terms of you know, these wide angle handheld lenses, and immersing you, feeling like you're a part of this world. That was transferred into the year 1900 New York, but that same kind of storytelling of allowing a scene to evolve within a shot or to change the shot dynamically to tell the story, but not necessarily follow who's talking, because who's talking is not important. It's how somebody's reacting to it. So from a technical standpoint and all the bells and whistles of how to make a movie, it's an amazing film. And then you put on there's a story behind it and performances that are fantastic and a commentary about who we are as people on top of that. It's just like, this is everything I want in a movie.
Yeah. The way I was trying to sell it to people who thought it was a war movie, just because of that photograph, that cover design, mm-hmm. that made it look like, I mean, it is, mm-hmm. but it makes it look like Owen is hiding behind a giant cinder block or something. The way I sold it was, it's a private eye film. Like, it's a yep. neo-noir. It's the nihilist noir.
It's absolutely. Right? It's a noir film.
Yeah, because it's hopeless, but not hopeless. Mm-hmm. It's about a quest and an investigation. It's mm-hmm. about people finding things out that they don't want to know. All of that stuff. And it's about the classic, you know, wronged man slowly regaining his purpose, which is, it's Rogue One now. It's the arc mm-hmm. of every great thriller.
Yes.
And it is a thriller, and it is a future noir, a neo-neoist. I don't know what the words are for this movie, because I do think in a lot of ways it's a synthesis of all of these genres that works in a new way,
yeah,
which is the thing that Cuarón does. Like, Gravity is a present-day science fiction movie, although he joked that it was actually set 2 years in the past when we had an active space shuttle program. Which, that's just annoying. But he is breaking ground and reinventing the cliches, playing with the relationships and our expectations. You know, we assume that Moore and Owen are going to rediscover their love together. No, that doesn't happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, a narrative, like, just breaking down the script today and sort of like, okay, looking at where the act breaks were and how they did it. It was so well done. Yeah. And just, I mean, I think there's 6 writers that are on this project, and you never know whose hands are all over what. But yeah.
And it bears almost no relationship to the original P.D. James novel.
Really?
Well, I mean, it's the threads are there, but so much of it, the James didn't have a lot of humor in it. It was a much more dour presentation. I think it was written, I'm going to blow this, but I think it was written in the mid-80s, and so it reflects a lot of that stuff.
Right.
And by updating it to the present and beyond, it just automatically, it's a nastier, angrier thing. Plus, there's the whole English person writing about England, which, with, you know, you bring in Cuarón and you bring in the Americans and you change the diversity of the approach makes it much more alive and interesting. And certainly Cuarón is aware of, and you know, he lives in London, and he's thinking through the way people look at him when he just walks around.
His experiences as an immigrant to that country, as an outsider,
completely inform the story.
Yeah, yeah. It's the POV of this film is, I will say, the thing that I took out of it today is that I found the film incredibly inspiring. Okay. I found it actually kind of hopeful, and I felt better about things after the movie than I did when I started it. And from so many levels, again, as somebody who's in the industry and does see behind the curtain and knows what goes into making these things, the story is sort of humanity distilled in a way. It's like, it's not pretty, but we can do good things if we're sort of forced into it.
Yeah.
But we mostly don't.
Yeah.
You know, and there's themes and bleakness to it another English film, Never Let Me Go. Do you remember that one?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we're recording this in December for the listeners, and I just dropped the Claire Armstrong episode on Never Let Me Go 2 weeks ago, so it's
very fresh for you.
Very fresh in my mind.
And again, it's dealing with these, what makes us human, and what's that spark, and why do we care, and how do you not become apathetic, and what does hope mean?
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really brilliant film. I saw that film by accident, by the way.
Oh, how did that
happen? At Toronto Film Festival when it was here, I thought I was going into, I think, the David Suzuki documentary.
Okay, yeah.
But I went into the wrong theater, and I'm like, wow, there's a lot of people here for this. And it was like 9 in the morning, and then seeing that film at 9 in the morning with the appropriate TIFF hangover that's a tough morning. That one's, you're a little raw, you know, you're a bit of a raw nerve at that time.
The best experiences, though, the best film experiences I've had at TIFF are being walloped like that, but not seeing something. And in fact, one of my other favorite movies of the last decade, Squid and the Whale, the Bombeck film, I saw that by mistake. Well, not by mistake, the 10 a.m. I was there for was canceled, the print didn't show up.
Right.
So I just went into the next room
Press screening,
10:30, it's short. It's 87 minutes. Yeah. Oh, man, I'm here.
Yeah.
I like this director. And then I come out and it's just like, well, that was my parents' divorce in slow motion. I don't need to, see that again.
That was awesome. For you, so when you saw this film,
yes.
You reviewed this film.
I did, yeah.
And yet nobody went to it.
Nope. Well, I have no impact.
Yeah.
I mean, I was...
No, I'm not saying in terms of review, but was it a positive review at the time?
Like, yeah. Oh, I think I 5 stars, best of.
Yeah.
I think we all said that. I mean, there were a couple of people who thought it was, I remember somebody at the time, I don't remember who it was, but someone said it was really, like, the bleakness was oppressive, and it's like, yeah, but if you don't plug into it, sure.
Yeah.
That's, you know, like, people have differing opinions on stuff, that's fine. But I think that was part of it, too. Like, you couldn't find a trailer. I've gone back and looked at the marketing, and none of it is really what the movie is.
I wonder if it got buried. Like, I wonder if, you know, for whatever reason, Universal had a different film they were pushing for Oscars at that year, or whatever it was. Because, I mean, that's really what we're talking about, is allocation of funds to market something.
Well, this is 2006. It's the year after Brokeback. Mm-hmm. Although that was Focus, not Universal. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, it's always depressing to go back and think about what wins and what doesn't.
Well, and you could, you know, you also have the executive shakeover. Like, somebody comes on board and they've got their baby that's up for, and they're going to push, you know, everybody puts their own child in the lifeboat first.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, sometimes films get lost. I you know, what was crazy is this was, you know, obviously one of my top films of that I'd seen, again, because of all the achievements in it. And then getting to work with Clive was, you know, they say don't meet your heroes, but it made it better. Yeah. It made the movie better.
Well, I was going to ask, because I just followed him around asking about it all day.
Mm-hmm. And that would... Well, you know, I actually really tried not to, because I was kind of geeking out a little hard. It was like my first day on set of The Nick, and, you know, one of my other top films of the decade was Traffic. And so I'm Steven Soderbergh sitting there holding the camera looking at me, and I turn around and Clive's looking at me because we're about to shoot this scene. And I had this moment where I just about crapped my pants, because it's like, when I thought about making movies and doing this, I wanted to do it with these people, and I'm doing that. And I kind of had a little freak out there for a second.
That's not intimidating at all.
No, not at all. Not at all. And I've totally flubbed my line that take.
Oh.
Because there was just like, it was like the hamster wheel got away and there was no way I was coming back. It's like, I need a second here. Okay, we're good. Let's go. And it was like, whoa, got to get a handle on that. But I wouldn't talk about it. I wouldn't ask him questions because I could have just done it for hours. But then I would, you know, listen around to see if he was, you know, sometimes he'd like start talking to somebody else about it or something else. And I'd just be like, you know, leaning in or like sort of sit closer and just want to hear about it. And so it was cool. It was really cool to you know, you look at a movie and a performance and you're like, wow, that was great. That actor's great. And then to actually see him in person being great, and his process and being a great person to work with, it was like, it was reaffirming that, you know, there's good people out there and you know, not everybody in the industry is a jerk, and you know, that good people do succeed.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, that was an interesting experience.
So did you catch anything? Did he say anything? Did you ever catch any pieces of information?
I don't know of any sort of specifics I could say that, but it's just the, just little bits, but you know, obviously, you know, and he, you know, he seemed to be quite proud of the film too. And I hope so, because it's, and, you know, I think he's, you know, it was a good experience, but it sounds like there could have been some brutal moments in shooting, because there were some very complicated setups in there, especially that whole tank sequence at the end. And yeah, that whole third act is huge.
Yeah.
Huge, huge, huge choreographed stuff in scope that I think we kind of got introduced to that big stuff in like Saving Private Ryan, you know, that storming the beach and that kind of chaos. But this was just done in a wholly different way.
Well, yeah, as you were saying, he takes this stuff and carries it forward. Mm-hmm. He's pushing the tech further, but he's also making sure that it's rooted in an emotional story. I mean, that's I really liked Y Tu Mamá También.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed it, but I didn't take anything away from, you know, the talk of it being this new Mexican cinema starting. It's like, well, this is fine, but there's other stuff that's good too.
Yeah.
And then I saw the Harry Potter movie he made, and holy shit, right? Like, it is the best one.
Yeah.
Yeah. He puts them in street clothes and it changes everything.
Absolutely.
Just they start acting like kids. You relate to them normally. And then you realize just how big the acting canvas is. Mm-hmm. There's a scene. It is. It's the third one. There is a scene with Gary Oldman, Timothy Spall, and who's the third actor? They're all Mike Leigh veterans.
Yeah.
And you're just, David Thewlis.
David Thewlis.
And they're all in it. And you just realize, oh, this is intentional. Like, the framing of this is designed to keep the kids out and just focus on the adults and make you think about what you're seeing and the fact that they're all actually acting instead of parading around in funny suits. Like, the first two movies are, if you filmed the book, this is what you would get if you held up the page.
Well, it's also kind of magical escapism, right?
Yeah.
I mean, and if you think, if you're 11 years old going into that film and that's sort of the age of the kids, you're like, it kind of feels like that. It's like, wow, this is fantastical and fantasy and fun. And then what he brought was this element of a little bit of reality into there and grounding, which is also kind of age appropriate for the kids too, right?
Yeah.
It's like, but that's got to handle on things. Things are getting serious.
Right. That's why they brought him to do it, to usher it forward again, right? Because you're going from weightlessness and pageantry to consequence and scary, like scary personal consequence.
Mm-hmm.
But what you get from that is from the director of Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, which makes me think that Universal, when they got this movie, they just, I think you're right. They just made the choice after choice that just put it in a corner and kept it. It should have been a summer release. It should have been a fall release.
But I also think it's a tough film to get audiences excited about.
Mm.
A little like Blade Runner 2049.
Yeah.
You know, there where it's, I think it's a fantastic movie. I thought, you know, visually it was stunning, like the design, like there's so many, that's the best I've seen Harrison Ford in a long time.
Yeah. Well, he's engaged, right?
Yeah, he's super engaged. But the takeaway from the story is like the polar opposite of what you get out of a Marvel movie.
Yeah.
Of, you know, you're special and unique and you're, you know, you're a brilliant, unique snowflake in the world. It's like, well, no, nobody's special. And if, when that's the takeaway, is that no, nobody's special. It's like, it's kind of hard for our audiences to come away from that. They go, yeah, nobody's special. Woo!
Yeah.
Can't wait to see you. You should see this about not being special. It's like, who's going to, you know, but at the same time, is it's a mature adult story with this incredible backdrop, beautifully done. And I think now, if this was a story that people were adapting, we'd see it on HBO. It'd be a TV series.
I was going to say, yeah, it has that Handmaid's Tale feel. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Handmaid's Tale, I think the adaptation reaches back to Children of Men very deliberately. Mm-hmm. And it's true. I mean, there is a chosen one in the film, but it's not the hero.
Yeah.
And who it is isn't introduced for the first 45 minutes, I guess. And she doesn't show up until the second act, really.
Yeah, the wheels are in motion, but we don't know why. There's this girl you got to get to the seaside.
Yeah,
go and talk to your, was it your cousin?
Yeah, and that's the other thing I love about the film is that, as in most film noir, your perspective, our hero is the guide to the world, not necessarily the guide to the story. So the processes that he has to go through are the way we learn about what's going on. Mm-hmm. There's no exposition that he already knows, which I think is great. No one ever repeats something to him that he would already know. It's all about us observing and seeing how, you know, Danny Houston's character has Guernica hanging in the wall on the wall because he can, because he's that powerful.
Yeah.
And that's unsaid. Like, he raided the Tate. There it is.
And it's brilliant. There's a line that Clive Owen's character has in this, like, you know, how do you do this? In 100 years there won't be a single poor bastard to look at this art. He's collecting the art, arc of the arts,
right?
Collecting these pieces of art from around the world. He's got the statue of David in his freaking living room. And, you know, in 100 years, nobody's going to care or nobody's going to be here to see
nobody
it.
Like, left, yeah.
And he goes, well, I just don't think about it, as he pops a pill to numb himself. As you know, and like, it's just like, you think about it, like, well, yeah, everything's fine as long as you don't think about it, as long as you don't care. Everybody can just keep skating along and not ask these questions.
Yeah. And I keep thinking that his character is the villain in a series of other movies that we haven't seen.
Totally.
Right? Like a heist film where they're going to get the art, whatever coup happened to keep him in power.
Mm-hmm.
And he's incidental. He really doesn't factor into the larger story. It's not about that.
But, I mean, that's the thing that the film does, is it paints this picture of this much larger world that really doesn't concern our character.
Yeah.
And then it's actually a very, very small story that is set in this dark, catastrophic world. And it's those layers that are so enriching. Like even when they leave Michael Caine's place, and they're meeting that character Sid, who's the border control agent, right?
The Peter Mullen rule.
Which
my Peter Mullen rule is that when Peter Mullen appears in a film, things are not getting better.
No.
Every single time.
But that location is a school.
Yeah.
That's just
disused.
It's just there's no reason for a school anymore. And there's this great imagery that goes throughout the film about animals, and that the animals are there, and that strangely that animals like Clive Owen's character, so it makes you like him a little bit more. Yeah. But there's animals all throughout the film that all seem to be doing just fine, which is kind of great. Yeah. Except for all the cows that were burning in the fields. All the other animals are like, we're good. We're just sort of waiting for you to die off, and we'll take over again. Yeah. And
it's just us.
It's a beautiful thing that they keep coming back to, as a theme of these animals just being attracted to climb. There's a kitten climbing his pants. He's petting a cat. The dogs like him. Yeah. There's a deer in the school. There's chickens on the stairwell. There's all of this.
Yeah. Nature's slowly reclaiming the earth anyway. They're not even waiting for us.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's that other aspect of it, of him being sort of kin to animals, that you think about St. Francis and you think about religious overtones. And that was the last time I saw it. I started thinking, well, this could take place in the 9th century. This doesn't have to be modern.
Absolutely.
It's so weirdly timeless for all the technology, for all the futurism. There really isn't anything he does that requires, you can't call anybody. There's like a heads up display. That's the closest thing to being a part of the story being told.
Yeah.
Because in the driving sequence, they need it for the beginning of the sequence, for us to understand what's happening.
Yeah.
But without that, I mean, just put people in chainmail and it would be like an Arthurian legend.
Well, and, maybe in the context of the film, I mean, I think the film is brilliant in how it was executed, and the production design and at all facets, like the creative minds that went into this. It's an achievement of that. But, maybe it would have been more palatable if you had set it in 2250 and this was a space opera, where it's the same thing, but you're telling it in outer space, the spaceships and all. It's the same story. And maybe that's what the audiences would have glommed onto, because it wouldn't have felt so close. Because this is a really uncomfortable film. It makes you feel uncomfortable. It's not a passive film. You can't just sit there and sort of laugh along or be amazed by visual effects. You're engaged. It's emotionally difficult. You're dealing with grief and death and hopelessness. Yeah. And it's not necessarily the things that people want to think about all the time, right? It's escapism, but it's not. It feels pretty real.
Yeah. Well, it's the disaster movie that, Deep Impact and Armageddon, it's an extinction level event. It's just happening so slowly that people do think about
it. So watching people get crushed by a glacier.
Yeah.
Right? It's just like, that's awful. And it's still awful.
Yeah.
And it's, oh God, it's still happening. It's like, it's not over quickly. It's nobody's ripping a Band-Aid off here. Yeah. It's awful.
This is a disaster movie by way of Cries and Whispers, where you're trapped in the room with the person who's dying.
Yeah.
And it's everyone. And
yeah.
I guess it is a harder sell than I first thought, but it's still a masterpiece.
Absolutely. And the artistic imagery, the biblical imagery, just the layers that you don't see necessarily. Well, I certainly didn't on first viewing, because I don't know. When a movie is good, I'm not thinking about those things.
Sure.
And I don't want to. It's like I said, I don't want to know how those shots were done, because to me it's magic and awesome and it really happened. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to know. And there's only a few movies or sequences that are like that. I'm just like, I don't want to know. Somebody can tell me later, or somebody, if I ever do one of those sequences in a movie, I'll just, plug my ears when they're talking about it. But it's the other side is that I do see behind the curtain all the time, and to be lost in a movie where I'm not thinking about the technical aspects. And it even happened to me today. I think I've seen this movie 3 or 4 times, and I still get lost in sequences where it's been 2 minutes, 3 minutes, I'm like, holy crap, this is still the same shot.
Yeah.
But I'm not thinking about it like, oh, this shot's still going. It's only either once that next cut happens or right towards the end, like, holy crap. because I'm so adrenalized, because I'm so immersed, it's almost like my brain checks off for a second, like, hey, we need to chill out for a second. Yeah. This is just a movie.
No, it's the best possible way to experience mm-hmm. something. I mean, that's when you're not suspending your disbelief. It's just put aside completely. It's not conscious. Mm-hmm. The scene I always come back to is the scene where we sort of haphazardly learn what happened in New York, the shot of the nuclear detonation. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't register because they're talking about, were your parents there? Mm-hmm. And that's how you would talk about something like that. That's
absolutely
there's a realism that runs through this science fiction movie that I've never really seen captured quite so well anywhere else. And it's the same realism he brought to Gravity. It's the same realism that's in the Harry Potter movie. I mean, mm-hmm. he somehow has an ear for it and just
such honesty.
Yeah.
And it's honesty from the camera as well.
Yeah.
You know, there is no milking of a moment with he lets the story happen in front of the camera and lets the camera reveal things, but doesn't force it down your throat. You feel much more like you're a witness to a conversation as opposed to the conversation being thrown at you.
Right.
And, you know, if there is a slow push in, it's slow and you're wide, right? You're not in an uncomfortable close-up of somebody while they're having a really very real moment. It's almost like you're far enough away where you kind of just want to be able to reach out and put out a hand and put it on the shoulder like it's going to be okay. But it feels authentic.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Soderbergh's style being similar in The Nick. It's something that's absolutely true. And it also made me think of the Dardennes and the way they handle stuff in these, you know, Belgian neorealist mm-hmm. films, this wave that they started and that everyone has picked up. You know, Aronofsky uses it in The Wrestler, and David O. Russell kind of borrowed it for The Fighter, and there's just this sense of the follow-along. And
yeah,
it's gone all the way back around again from naturalistic to ostentatious, mm-hmm. where now if I see an indie film start that way, it's just like, well, I know what they saw. I know what their reference points are.
Mm-hmm.
But with Cuarón, with Soderbergh, like Soderbergh has always been this sort of, he's been dinged for it in the past, mm-hmm. being the cerebral observer. But I mm-hmm. love that about his work.
Absolutely.
And Cuarón has the same thing, but he works in genre exclusively.
Yeah.
So it's never, he never gets the credit for it.
Yeah.
For the same kind of thing. Like just the camera's not always obviously handheld. Sometimes it's on a gimbal, but it moves it breathes in a way that Soderbergh's camera
there.
Breathes. Yeah, you're aware that there's stuff going on beyond the frame. And you're always kind of ready for a turn or a tilt to direct your attention, mm-hmm. but because something interesting is happening, not because something interesting is about to happen.
Well, and I think what as clever as some of those sequences are, they're not it doesn't feel that they're done with ego, if that makes any sense.
You were gonna say showy, right?
Like there's not like, look what I can do.
Yeah.
It's not masturbatory in any way. It's not like, look at how cool my shot is. It's how does this serve the story? And it seems like that's the question asked first all the time.
Mm.
How does this serve the story? And when that happens, it's just, again, it's just this incredible honesty is coming the other way. So it makes it difficult. It makes it difficult for an audience. But that's I think, why I'm so engaged with this film. It's like, it feels so honest. Performances are honest. You know, Clive has these incredible moments in the film, again, where, you know, his wife he hasn't seen for 20 years. They're essentially burying her in the woods. He steps away for a second. The camera never cuts, and he has a quiet moment huddled against a tree trying to process his grief, and it's like, nope, time to go. And it's like, okay, wipe my eyes and suck it up and moving on. But it's just so honest.
Hmm.
You know, it puts you, like, there's no big showy, like, or even ridiculously stoic where he's sitting there with the single tear watching. It's like, it's basically, screw that. This is life. And it's fantastic.
Yeah.
I keep coming back to saying this film's so great, but it really is.
It's kind of the point, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'm really glad you chose it, because it's a film that I have loved and fought for and watched die over and over and over mm-hmm. again when people are like, oh, it was kind of long, I didn't start it. It's not that long.
Oh my God, it's a 2-hour movie.
It felt so weighty. And I think maybe part of that was the almost unanimous critical acclaim that read as hostile to some people because, you know...
Well, if you all think it's great.
It's a big, serious movie, right? Yeah. Well, it is, but it's also pure cinema and the... You know, it's exhilarating. It is a wonderful film. It is a quietly hopeful movie that leaves you on a high, even though, you know, you've basically... The saddest images have been rolling past you. But it's a film that recaptures... I mean, just as the restoration of hope to the world is the theme of the movie, it's just like this movie made me believe in filmmaking in a way it hadn't in a while.
I don't mean this cynically at all, but I don't think this movie would get made today at all. No matter who was at the helm. I don't know who would... And I think maybe that was even a bit of the issue when it came out. Like, it's a risky film. How do you make your money back? You know, everybody's asking, can we do this in TV? You know, had this film come out in 2000 or 2001, it might have been a different story. Mm-hmm. You know, when films like Traffic and Saving Private Ryan. Saving Private Ryan, I think, was the biggest box office of that year. It was it was the biggest movie that year.
So, and it was a summer release. That might have helped.
It was a big, you know, nasty, raw look at war. I mean, yeah, it had Tom Hanks in it, but, like, it's a brutal film. And, you know, maybe after... maybe it was after in the middle of the Bush years and Cheney and stuff like that, people didn't want to be dealing with this.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's certainly intent behind scenes of the military while...
Homeland Security, stuff.
While England and the U.S. are in Iraq.
Yeah.
Because that was already happening by the time...
That's even in one of the... that's even in one of the set deck pieces. In I believe, Michael Caine's... house.
Oh,
it's like
newspaper clippings.
Yeah, it's like, you know, he had like the different, you know, press clippings and things like that, and it's like, stop the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
You know, stop bombing Iraq or something like that. Like, it's right in there.
Yeah. And it's a message that could work for 1991 or for 2003, and it's equally valid. It's the sameness of it all, right? Like, the sense that this is the last conflict, too, that goes through what everybody's emotions, that everyone's exhausted and everyone's tired, and they're tired of fighting, but they're pushing on. It's what Owen is, you know. Again, it's the film noir thing. Like, it's the Seamus with one more case who just doesn't want to do it.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it, right? It's the, you know, the alcoholic hangdog guy down on his luck. He's going to do one, you know, do this for the $5,000 or whatever, and then, you know... Turns out that he's emotionally invested in this after all, and the money doesn't matter. It's like, it's cliche when you frame it like that.
Sure.
But the execution isn't. And it's sort of a brutal take on humanity. And I think maybe that's why I like it so much too. Is that it doesn't sugarcoat what we do to each other or who we are or opinions and the lengths that we're willing to go to fight for a misguided cause. Because that's the other thing, is like the rebellion that's going on in this, where they're fighting against the government that's being awful to immigrants. They're by all intents and purposes fighting the good fight, except for the things that they're doing, which are just as equally awful.
Yeah.
Right. And so, like, there is no heroes in war. There's just loss. And that's sort of what it's showcasing. It's just like, this is just all awful.
Yeah.
You know, and to sort of claim that, I think when we put those bright and shiny patriotic or those sort of war hero archetypes up, I mean, it's like, it's a great way of deluding ourselves as to what it really is.
Yeah.
But it's just, you know, this film doesn't do that. It does everything to the contrary of that. So again, for a country that was still ingrained in the war in Iraq, and you know, soldiers are still dying, I can see how it wouldn't necessarily have been palatable to, you know, the flyover states and people that aren't film lovers.
Yeah.
It's a tough sell.
Yeah. I'm kind of disappointed that it hasn't been rediscovered, too. Like, it's...
Right?
It's floating around, and people know about it, and you know, all my friends have seen it.
Yeah.
I've insisted they watch it. But, you know, Universal didn't treat it particularly well on home video. I have an HD DVD.
HD DVD. Amazing.
Back at the time, they released it on both formats, which was good.
And it's signed by...
I got Quaron to sign it. Amazing. I am not an autograph hound, but every now and then, like, I've had the opportunity to meet somebody whose work I don't just admire, but but, you know, truly love or change my perspective. I got Soderbergh to sign, you know, that Kyanuskatsi box because he produced Nakoikatsi. But I also, it was this big event when Reggio brought visitors here.
Yeah, I was there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, I did the press day the next day, and I got them all this, like, Philip Glass. How am I not going
to
do that?
It was amazing. I tried not to geek out, because this was right before I started the Knicks, so I actually went. It was like research.
Oh, were you because I was
about to, like, 2 weeks later, or a week and a half later, I was going to New York to start the Knicks, so it was like, I sat in the audience and watched Soderbergh moderate this panel.
Yeah, I was there.
And then I was at a restaurant, and Reggio was at this restaurant, and Philip Glass is sitting across from me. Philip Glass is one of my favorite composers. I'm like, I'm kind of freaking out again. Like, oh my God, it's right there. Trying not to geek out, but it's like, oh, if I had had a copy of the DVD, it would have definitely been asking him to sign it.
I went all in. It is entirely possible in my memory that this was the same day.
Oh my God.
That I had seen Gravity and did the interviews, because it might
have been. Oh, yeah, right? I saw Gravity at the festival that year too.
And it So, yeah, the next day was the interview day. And so I had the Soderbergh thing in the morning, and it was him and Reggio, and Glass was there, and I'm going to forget his name, but the editor was also there.
Mm-hmm.
And then that afternoon I had 20 minutes with Cuarón.
That's just a great day.
Yeah, it is.
That's just a great day.
I don't get to complain about anything. And
that's an awesome day.
He was so delighted that I had the HD DVD, because he said, oh, it's obsolete tech. It's perfect for the movie. And I'm like, yeah. But then he shamed me into buying the Blu-ray, because he prefers the transfer. There was a new transfer done a couple years after that. And so he said that there's a double pack, and he winced when he told me. He's like, well, there's one with Repo Men. But it's not Repo Man. It's the Jude Law crappy shot in Toronto movie that
right. Yeah.
But that's how people see Children of Men now. It's boxed with these two posts.
It's the sort of like sci-fi weird thing, war thing. And dystopia. It's so not that film.
Yeah.
But again, I mean, you know, here we are sort of crapping on Universal of how they release it. But I'm like, I don't know how you do it. Like, what is this? Like, you go and see this movie. It's going to make you feel really awful for a while and question a lot of things in your life. But ultimately, things will be okay.
you have to die, but it'll be all.
Yeah, exactly. Like, how do you? But it's just, and then we should talk about the cinematography on it as well, because there's some groundbreaking cinematography. Yeah. From
Chivo, Emmanuel Lubezki.
Yep.
I just double checked to make sure.
Who's one of the premier cinematographers out there. The Revenant, right?
Gravity.
Gravity.
Did he win three Oscars in a row? Isn't he the first
one? Nominated for three in a row. I don't know. Did he win three in a row? I mean, he easily could. I mean, it's just...
I think it was Gravity, Birdman, and The Revenant in that order.
Bang, oh, jeez. Yeah, and well-deserved. I mean, again, technically forward-thinking, pushing cinema forward, which is, it's the Academy of Arts and Sciences. People forget about the sciences part, but it really is like pushing technology forward, pushing how we tell stories. It's like coming up with a whole new style of paintbrush. Yeah, and you're a bunch of painters, and you're like, hey, have you ever tried one of these? And it's like, wow, I never thought I could do that with a camera.
Yeah.
And it's just brilliant. It's brilliant. And there's this Twitter account that I follow. It's called One Perfect Shot.
Oh yeah,
and the amount of times I see his work and work from this movie, I'm like, retweet everybody. You just go see this movie if you like this shot, because it's freaking genius.
Yeah, and it's funny you mention the seamlessness of the work in Children of Men. Mm-hmm. I find the work he does for Iñárritu much showier, because that's the kind of filmmaker Iñárritu is.
Absolutely.
He just wants to let you know how much work he's putting into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always going to be on Cuarón's side, because show me what you think is important, not your own sweat and tears. I know you killed yourself making this movie.
Yeah. Well, I mean, The Revenant is a spectacle, and for so many reasons. But again, that's sort of the difference of the two filmmakers. Mm-hmm. And you know, each have their
merits.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of, I mean, like, it's like you the way Fincher treats a camera is so very different, you know, with that sort of like cool character matching camera movement, which is so precise and so specific. I mean, that's an achievement in its own right. Like the choreography that goes into that, and executing that, and the perfection, it's stunning.
Yeah.
When you start breaking down little movements and shots that just it's mastery in terms of, and that's got to be painstaking to get.
Yeah, I mean, dozens of takes, apparently, yeah. And some of her acting, some of her camera choreography.
To make it all work.
Yeah, but as a result, his movies have that sort of chill feeling where everything is very tense all the time, but very placid at the same time. Mm-hmm. And it's a great vibe, but again, you know what you're getting when you go to a Fincher film. When you go to an Iñárritu film, you know you're going to watch an endurance test of some sort.
Yeah.
The thing about Children of Men is that it is, in so many ways, it's classical, it's formal, it's all, you know, like it's object-based cinematography. I don't know how else to describe it. You're watching the thing that is most important, even if you're coming at it from a different angle, but it's never insisting that you watch it. It's just there.
Yeah. You're just left there there's great moments where, you know, all the dialogue is happening in the background and you're just sort of seeing how Clive Owen's character deals with it.
Mm-hmm.
And just sitting there and you're watching people in an environment as opposed to dictating the environment, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Even though it's so designed and set up, but to make it look like it's not, you know, that to make it look like it, oh, we just happen to be here.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
All these futuristic locations or more near future locations, the things that are in them did not exist before we built this set.
Yeah.
And it still feels lived in and happened upon. This is the thing I was talking about with Alex Hooper in her episode about Brazil, is that was the first time she understood that the ducts were there on purpose, that everything in the film was bespoke.
Yeah.
And it's something that I really try to appreciate in sci-fi and speculative stuff, because you have to think about everything. Just as, you know, George Miller on Fury Road insisted that every object have two purposes, because it was the thing it was and then the thing that it is now. There's like hedge clippers on his mask and stuff like that, and it's all fascinating, exhausting. They had to design a quietus kit. You're like, what would it look like?
And a commercial.
Product? Yeah.
There was a full commercial for
how
that.
How do you sell that product?
You know, how
to
do
people?
You sell the product of, you know, the at home suicide kit? But it was genius.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you could sell that thing today and people would buy it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it was, the design of that was beautiful. Like the production design of this film, there is not a object out of place. There, you know, from the graffiti to, you know, the art in the background.
Yeah. And the choices of that art, the stuff that exists and the new stuff.
Yeah, it's just, and then, you know, I was worried, actually, going back into watching it this morning. Yeah. I was worried, because you never know, like, you love a film, you leave it for a while, and you come back, and there's always that little bit of worry for me in rewatching something that I love, that I'm going to find the flaws, and I'm going to be kind of bummed out.
Sure.
I'm like, it's not as good as I remember. And part of that's contextually, too, because, you know, the language of cinema can change over time. Audience expectation changes over time. My own life experience changes over time. But this one just held up. I should say, too, what was crazy about watching this the first time in the theaters is I was sitting next to my wife, who was pregnant, and my friend's wife, who was also pregnant.
Oh, my God.
It was awesome. Like, there was, like, babies alive and kicking in their tummy while we watched this, and they were getting rumbled. Or was my wife? My wife wasn't pregnant. Our friend was. Or maybe Adria didn't know she was pregnant yet. It was just, like, nuts. And so, like, at one point, her baby is, like, full on, you know, during these big loud sequences,
arguing,
like, full on kicking back. And you're like, holy crap. Like, we all kind of walked out of it shell-shocked, because we were both expecting a child that year. And it was just like, whoa, this is heavy. This is heavy stuff. This is all very real.
God.
It was an awesome way to see
it. The best possible.
Certainly made it very grounded.
Yeah.
And, it was, you know, you're looking at your own wife of, like, this vision of Madonna at this time, too. And, like, the imagery that comes into that. And just, like, it's just so much empathy and fear that played into that. And, you know, I have a preteen now, and it held up.
God,
and I didn't need that extra the real life circumstance.
Yeah. Jesus, that's probably the best way to see that movie.
Yeah,
just to know it's not real.
Just to
be able to reach over.
Reach over and touch the belly and make sure, like, we're still good. This is a really scary proposition I'm looking at right now. Yeah, I totally forgot about that until this morning rewatching. I'm like, oh yeah, everybody was all preggers when we were watching this. Oh, God. Yeah.
So, I mean, you've already sort of discussed it with the stalking Clive Owen for background stories, but is there anything about Children of Men now that has, that you've stolen or lifted or borrowed? Is there something in your creative DNA that's in there?
I think one of the things, and I alluded to it with, you know, Soderbergh as well, is putting the camera where the story is. And that's not necessarily what it looks like in the script. Of that efficiency of breaking down, what is this really about? Mm-hmm. And getting, you know, Children of Men is a great example of that. And getting to watch Soderbergh do it for two seasons of The Nick, where just breaking down a scene and where he would find the story of the scene, which necessarily wouldn't be what you'd think it was if you were just reading the script, but then sitting back and looking at it and going, that's where the story is. This is about how this person feels about this, not about what this person is saying. And then having the gravitas to just let the camera live there and not shoot the other coverage, right? Yeah. I think, you know, there's the sort of Michael Bay, Marvel, you know, lots of cutting, lots of spectacle. Let's just cover it from all angles and then see what we get later, right? Yeah. It's like, put all the shots in there and then we'll see what we got later. And not to say that there's not a lot of forethought that goes into, you know, I don't know how someone to make a Transformers movie. Like, I wouldn't even know where to start.
Mm-hmm. And those things are so big and expensive that you want insurance, right? Yeah. You need to know that you have the shot.
Yeah. And if it didn't work, you need a backup.
Right.
Whereas, you know, the boldness of what Children of Men is and how Soderbergh approached Nick and Gravity, where you're like, we're just going to let this shot live. And obviously the technical component of what went into Gravity was insane in terms of how they had to actually shoot that. Again, pushing cinema forward. But how this felt so real, and that to me is the big takeaway for me. It's just how honest it was, how the camera was honest, how it felt like there was no ego behind the lens, where it wasn't about what the director wanted to show you. It was like, this is what the story demands you see. And to have that perspective as a filmmaker, that's got to take a lot of restraint in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. It's because, yeah, everybody wants to shoot cool shit. Everybody wants to do something really cool.
Yeah.
But to take the ego out of it and just allow it to be what it needed to be, and not, you know, get 9 angles on this super cool explosion you just did or whatever it is. And not to say that there's not, that long shots are what that means. I mean, there's incredibly effective cuts in this film.
Yeah.
And quicker sequences, but I just, that attention to let the story be the story and not get in its way. That to me is what it is. I mean, it sounds crazy that these amazing constructed shots where you have to be full of gravitas to even go after that. Like, we're going to do this. You have to have a very healthy ego, but then to not impart that ego onto the lens, that takes some definite maturity and restraint, I would think. I don't know if I would ever get there. Yeah. That's a challenge, and it's just not playing safe, but being bold and daring and egoless at the same time.
Yeah, for lack of a better term, that's where art comes from.
Like, yeah.
And it's not created to reflect its glory. It's just like, I think he just wants to tell the story and get out of its way, which is just incredible.
Which is admirable, right? There's so many people looking to impart things on a story or push a narrative or push their POV. And I mean, while you can do that, there's subtle ways. And I find that to be the most mind-blowing thing about this film, is that it's a whole incredible world that they constructed, but it just feels very honest, and the choreography feels very grounded, and the tension that they create feels very real, and it doesn't feel like there's any lies in this film, you know, because like there's a, to me, somebody, I don't remember who said this to me, it's probably, I don't know who it was, but you might know this quote, but every time you cut, you're telling a lie. Right? Every time you make an edit, you're telling a lie.
Okay.
So make it a good lie. Make it an honest lie. Make it something that, make that lie one that pushes it forward. Because it's not real. It's right. It's not authentic. It's you're cutting to a whole new place or a different POV. And so if you're lying, make sure you know why you're lying. don't just throw a bunch of lies in there and hope that one of them catches and people will be discombobulated and it's good enough. It's make it worthwhile.
It sounds like Billy Wilder.
No, maybe. Like
somebody with that kind of command of mm-hmm. narrative.
Yeah.
I can believe it.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds like an oversimplification of an incredibly challenging job, but it's to be able to look at it like that and go, okay, the Russian filmmaker, what's his name? Tarkovsky. You see some of the longer shots that he would do and allowing a shot to evolve. And that kind of attention is like, you definitely see that in these works.
Yeah.
You know, you see that evolution of things like he was doing in Stalker, where there's these long, incredibly short post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, of The Wasteland, which is more or less, I mean, that's the closest analog I can think to what Cuarón is doing here. Mm-hmm. It's showing us The Wasteland as it's being created.
Yeah.
Like, the world is ending.
Yeah.
And whatever comes next is going to be the stuff of Tarkovsky films if we don't turn it around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a prequel.
Yeah, I guess so.
Jesus Christ.
That got heavy. What's your biggest takeaway from this film?
I think the thing that shocks me is how modern it still feels. Mm. Like, it hasn't dated. That's the beauty of, you know, a futuristic story or a really good period piece, is that they'll tell you about the period they were made, but they'll still play.
Yeah.
Because they're, you know, with the exception of something like Star Wars, where the hairstyles tell you, you know, that's a bit of a giveaway. There's really nothing about this movie that dates it. And the pessimism is certainly more relevant, but it's not a pessimistic movie. The characters are pessimistic, but the film is optimistic, which is the thing I love about it, is that you get that balance.
Mm-hmm.
It's constantly showing you what is worth fighting for by making them discover it.
Yeah.
And so we get to be maybe not a step ahead exactly, but you're right next to them on this ride, and it's less important because these movies... The possibility of an unhappy ending is there, but the more time you spend in the world, the more you really want to believe that it's going to have a happy ending, which is the rediscovery of hope that the movie is putting the characters through.
Yeah.
I think it played me like a violin by making me accompany them, literally. I mean, we're riding along. That's what this movie is. And it wasn't until the second and third viewing that I saw what I was riding through. It was really more about the trip. And that's fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely.
It put me out of my critical head and made, like, it was a hard review to write. It was an easier review to write because I was enthusiastic, but it was hard to piece it together in a way that was coherent because I just, you know, I wanted to say, this is really something and you should go.
It's a feeling.
Yeah.
Right? As opposed to an event. Yeah. So, and maybe that's the challenge of why people didn't get to see it, because it's hard to, you know, I don't know how long we've been talking now, but it's hard to sort of contextualize how you feel about a film when there's a lot of layers to it. And you're really talking about feelings that come up of while watching it, and very personal feelings.
Yeah.
Again, cynicism and hope. And what does that mean to us? And what is that? What would that look like? Oh God. Like, it's just, it goes on. It's a deep cut, this film.
Yeah. And people talk about, you know, Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049 as existential science fiction, which they absolutely are. This is too, but because it looks modern and more or less present day, it's harder to explain to people that it is sci-fi or that it is anything. I mean, just like...
But I also know some people like, oh, it's sci-fi, I don't want to watch it because they don't like that genre, whatever the heck that means.
Right. I usually think there's going to be either lightsabers or flying cars.
Yeah.
And, okay, yes, Blade Runner has flying cars, and they're pretty cool, but that's not what it's about.
But it's like Arrival sci-fi, but it's not sci-fi. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's a human story, but just transplanted into, you know, again, like 15 minutes in the future.
Yeah. Well, Villeneuve said the way he saw Arrival was that it was basically, it's people facing a challenge they didn't expect to face. Mm-hmm. And that is absolutely anything. Like, that can be...
That's absolutely... It's so universal.
The kid with a disease. I mean, it's all in there. But, you know, it can be whatever specific challenge in that film that you want it to be. And then you don't even have to have aliens, and you don't have to have a broken chronology. It can simply be about that. It's about worrying about what to do next. Mm-hmm. And this movie is absolutely that. There's choice after choice after choice. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how completely relatable it is for a situation that neither of us should ever be able to expect to face.
Yeah.
It's just drama. It's just there.
Absolutely. But it just feels so tangible. It feels like this could be us.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, to a certain part of the population, how offensive this would feel. This film would be capable of really pissing a bunch of people off because... Mm-hmm. You know, however, their ideology might not fall in line with this.
Yeah.
And that would be pretty challenging. It's not necessarily safe subject matter all the time. It's not necessarily kind of stuff you'd even want to talk about at Thanksgiving dinner, because it certainly could polarize the room, right?
Yeah,
I mean, talking about things like immigration and childbirth and like, people have pretty strong emotions on these things, and depending on how you're raised, and also, you know, the film, how it depicts, you know, the religious sect in terms of like, oh, you know, what is this? Are these the groups that just kneel down and try and repent? No, this is the other group that just flagellate themselves in order to have, it's like, it's, yeah. doesn't, it's not painting them in religions in a very good light.
No, it's great how nimble it is too, about whether this is potentially supernatural or theological. Mm-hmm. I mean, the character's name is Theo. It's so good. Yeah. It's there for you if you want to think about it, but it's not really.
Yeah.
And the idea that on some level we deserve it, which we talked about at the beginning, just floats around there all the time.
Yeah. We did this to ourselves.
Yeah. If it did happen, why did it happen? Mm-hmm. And that, by setting it in a place where we're past worrying about that, it just makes it linger in the memory so much more. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's just, you know, God damn it, it's a perfect movie. It really is.
I'm so glad. Like, that's the thing. It's like, that was going to be my statement. I'm like, it's perfect movie. Come at me. Yeah. This is so much easier when we agree.
Well, that's what Twitter's for, I'm sure.
Absolutely, yeah. Just everybody read this, and then, you know, you got a hot take. Come at me.
Come at us both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's awesome, and you should see it. Better yet, go buy it and watch it again and again, because it's great.
I just keep thinking there's a Criterion Edition that should be made. If we can make that happen. You know Soderbergh. Get him on this.
Yeah, make it. Do it.
They're tight.
Do it. Make this... Make it. We need the Criterion on this.
There's a special feature.
I don't want to watch the special features. I don't want to know. I desperately want to know. Like, I desperately, desperately want to know, but I kind of don't. It's just like, you know, Hogwarts is real. I don't want to know how you did it. Let's just let it be.
My thanks to Eric Johnson, who you can see returning as Jack Hyde in 50 Shades Freed in theaters literally everywhere this Friday from Universal Studios. Eric also co-stars with Alan Hawke, Paul Gross, and Tori Anderson in Caught, a new CBC miniseries premiering Monday, February 26th. He's also just joined the cast of Vikings, which is why you might have seen him around with a really big beard lately. You can find Eric on Twitter at EricJJohnson79, all one word, and you can find Children of Men on Blu-ray and DVD from Universal Studios Home Entertainment. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you feel like leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or wherever, that would be greatly appreciated. Every little bit helps, it truly does. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening.